hosting my own radio show for the last 10 years and filling in on Coast to Coast here for going on three now. One of the topics that's always fascinated me is that of remote viewing. What exactly is this ability? Is it real? Is it imagined? Is it something that everyone is capable of doing? It's interesting to me because some of the people I've spoken to, including David Morehouse and others, have said that it is not actually a psychic ability, but they can't always put a finger on exactly what it is that is transpiring. What is going on with this? Tonight, our guest has a very interesting book, and this is what fascinated me about it. The title of the book, A Sorcerer's Apprentice, A Skeptic's Journey into the CIA's Project Stargate. We're going to listen from a skeptical point of view, somebody that was involved in this program who has a different, unique perspective on this. And how did he rectify this going into it with a skeptical point of view? Did that keep him from being successful early on? Did it maybe make him even more successful because he questioned more? That's what we'll tackle tonight throughout the show. Fascinating topic. Tonight we welcome John Harlosky, former police officer and instructor and expert in the field of human performance technologies, who, as a skeptic, as I mentioned, was perhaps one of the last people to become a believer in the power of consciousness-related phenomena. We'll discuss how he became an operational remote viewer, along with the turmoil he felt as his long-held beliefs clashed with the powerful implications of his experiences. The Sorcerer's Apprentice, that's the book. We'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest for the next 3 hours, John Harlosky, has worked for two large metropolitan police departments as a police officer and academy instructor. He's been trained in SWAT tactics and is a designated marksman. He is considered an expert in the field of human performance technologies and has spent half his life in the martial arts. He was the co-director and co-founder of the nonprofit think tank, the Institute for Evolutionary Technologies, as well as the co-director of Project Trojan Warrior II, a mind-body integration training program. His book, A Sorcerer's Apprentice, A Skeptic's Journey into the CIA's Project Stargate, is out and available right now. John, thank you for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you for having me, Dave.
As I said in the opening, this has always been something that intrigues me, the whole idea behind this and the fact that our government was actually actively pursuing this as something for intel collection and expanding our consciousness horizons. Talk to me a little bit about your beliefs coming into this before you were totally, you know, introduced to remote viewing and being a skeptic yourself. When you heard about this project and going on, how did you open yourself up to even the possibility of this being something other than a flight of fancy?
Well, to be quite honest, I thought it was a flight of fancy when I first heard about it. My background is very much scientifically oriented. Both of my parents are teachers, or were teachers, they're retired now. And my majors in college were mathematics with minors in engineering and philosophy. So I've never looked upon anything regarding psychic or psychic ability or ESP as anything other than a flight of fancy. The most I could say about it was that maybe a few people had certain abilities, but that even that was debatable. So I was a complete skeptic, but I had an open mind. And when I first started getting into remote viewing, although I was a skeptic, I was interested enough to try and find out the real truth behind it.
Well, let's talk about that. When you are approached with this, what is the first line to you? I mean, how do they start to explain to you what this is? And do they sell it as a psychic phenomena, or how are they representing this to you?
Well, I got actually interested in remote viewing and the Project Stargate when I read an expose by a former major in the U.S. Army by the name of David Morehouse. And he wrote a book back in 1997 called Psychic Warrior, where he explained his experiences in Project Stargate. And this was from somebody who, like myself, had no previous experience in any psychic phenomena. And when I first saw the book, I thought it was fiction, science fiction. But when I read the inside cover, I realized that this was not fiction, this was reality. And I was struck especially by the thought that not only was the United States intelligence services and the military involved in psychic spying using ESP as an intelligence asset, but also the fact that they took who was, you know, basically a hard-headed special ops ranger company commander and taught him how to be psychic. That's the part that I found just completely amazing.
Well, talk to me a little bit about this then. For listeners who are new to this and are not exactly sure what remote viewing is, give us a definition, at least from your perspective, and kind of encapsulate what is remote viewing? How is it done?
Okay, well, basically, remote viewing is a scientifically validated form of extrasensory perception, whereby the viewer is able to extend his consciousness, both in space and time, to view persons, places, objects, or events outside the normal five modes of perception. And, let's see, undiminished by shielding or distance. It's clairvoyance. If you want to use another term, that probably would be easier for those who are not familiar with the terminology of remote viewing.
When you look at something like this and the idea behind this and somebody trained David Morehouse, where does this philosophy, where does this belief come from, origin for remote viewing? It had to begin somewhere to be taught. What information do you have on that?
Well, throughout the ages, there's always been the use of psychic abilities. I mean, you can go all the way back to Greece and the Oracle at Delphi, right up through the Elizabethan age with Dr. John Dee, and all the way up through into the former Project Stargate. At that time, back in the 1970s, there were rumors floating around that the Soviets were involved in psychic research. And the powers that be, so to speak, felt that we might fall into a psychic gap, so to speak. And at that time, you know, during the height of the Cold War, they were willing, both sides were pretty much willing to try anything if it would give them an advantage.
Right.
And I think that's where they overcame their natural reluctance to embrace the idea, which was basically New Age stuff, of using psychics as an intelligence asset. But I think the really good thing, the really cool thing was that the CIA they took the idea, they wanted something more than just charlatans or the Miss Cleo psychic hotline or something like that. You know, I mean, they wanted to approach it from a scientific standpoint. First of all, they wanted to find out, is it possible? And so they approached two laser physicists who were working for the Stanford Research Institute and asked them if they would be willing to try an initial project to find out whether or not they could use psychic ability, or ESP, as an intelligence gathering asset. And these two gentlemen, Hal Putoff and Russell Targ, agreed to do so. And that's where the program actually started coming into place. And they found after experimentation that there was something to this, that it could actually be used as an intelligence asset. And they didn't approach it from the idea of psychic ability. They approach it as a human ability that everyone was able to do. It was something innate in everybody. And that's the way that they approached it. And they used the scientific method to discover whether or not they could actually do intelligence gathering using this method, so to speak.
Doesn't it seem funny that we're trying to rely on science to prove or disprove something that there's really no way to measure other than just putting it into effect? How do you make a hypothesis and test it without actually doing it first?
Exactly. And that's why I think this program was just head and shoulders above everything else at the time, because first of all, they were trying to make operational an effect that was looked upon as being, for the most part, fraudulent, or at the very least, uncontrollable. But these two men, these two physicists, both of them had interests on the side in finding out what were the physical reasons why people had psychic events or had psychic ability. And so having that much of an open mind and being solid scientists, that's the way they approach the problem.
All right, well, you've got now, theoretically, the idea of, okay, we should, if consciousness is an energy, we should be able to transcend the physical form. But then again, you have to decide, where does consciousness lie? Does it exist within the body? Is it an auric field around our body that we can push out and extend? That just seems to me like so many different theoretic ideas behind it. It's so interesting that the government decided to pour money and time into investigating this, because it's something that I don't think would ever be able to put a thumbprint on and say, yes, this is what's going on.
We still haven't to this day. We still don't understand what consciousness is. We still don't understand why remote viewing works. We don't know how it works, what mechanism is involved. And consciousness itself, we don't truly understand yet. So here you have two men who are trying to figure out an operational use of a technology that no one has any idea how it works.
about a job that's tough to start building any kind of security in, right?
Yeah,
how do you start even testing a theoretical idea behind that? That's like, just an amazing moment. Now, let me ask you this, though. Okay, you've got something like remote viewing. In 2015, if this was something that was, just being introduced now, do you think they would even put any stock or time into it with how high-tech our world has become? We can see through walls, we can see through bunkers, we can see through the earth, and we can hear and pick up audio and all of this. Do you think that they would even consider testing this theory if it started now as opposed to when it was originally being tested?
That's a very interesting question. Nowadays, there is so much in the arena of modern high-tech weapons. I mean, we've actually moved into the arena of science fiction. We have nuclear submarines a la Jules Verne, and we have laser weapons now a la H.G. Wells. So you kind of think your question is very applicable. How would remote viewing fit in this type of a world versus 20 years ago? Well, the fact of the matter is that there was a paper, I don't exactly remember when it came out. It may have been in the mid-2000s, perhaps a little bit later than that. It was written by, of all people, a Navy SEAL. His name was Brem Seth. He was a lieutenant commander, and he was at the Marine War College doing a dissertation. And his dissertation was on asymmetric and transcendental warfare in the 21st century, the operational use of remote viewing. So the interest in this particular technology is still there. We're still in a situation where, although we're not technically in a Cold War, we are fighting terrorists. We are fighting people who hide in the shadows, people who don't have set allegiances, and people who hide in civilian groups and use them as shields. So all your high-tech weaponry may not have the same effect under those circumstances. And that's what Commander Bremseth was trying to show. He was trying to say that perhaps we need to move to a different approach to warfare, and that remote viewing worked in the past. There's no reason to believe that it wouldn't work now. And perhaps with a Manhattan-style project, this could provide a technology that would have every bit as much, if not more, effect than the atomic bomb. I mean, consider this. Modern weaponry, the weaponry that we use, the weapons that the Russians use, the Chinese use, all the advanced nations of the world, all rely on electronics and computers. Well, if you don't have a stable output on those computers, then you're going to have a situation where your weaponry and your communication, your intelligence, is not going to be reliable, which could put you at a disadvantage mm-hmm. against your opponent. And consider this. One of the things that Brem Seth mentioned was the use of what is called micro-PK, or micro psychokinesis. And that's the ability to affect a statistical electronic mechanism. And it's been shown that people like remote viewers, or just people in general, because this is an innate ability, both of them, can influence the output of an electronic device. Now, if you can imagine an opponent who, with a trained group of people, could change the output of your electronic devices such that what they are presenting you was false information, that could have a huge impact on a modern battlefield. So it was Brem Seth who felt that remote viewing and other applied consciousness technologies is the way to go in the future in a new type of warfare called transcendental warfare. So to him, and frankly to other remote viewers, this is the way of the future. This is a technology that should be pursued.
John, we have to take a break. John Herlosky, our guest this evening, and we'll continue talking about his book. When we come back from the break, what exactly is remote viewing used for? And does it have value for everyday life? How does that work? What are the applications? We'll cover that. And then I want to dig into what's it like for somebody that doesn't believe in this and has a skeptical viewpoint to actually open themselves and get past their own psyche, their own id, in order to make this work. That's what we'll cover. You're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. If you are intrigued by the strange world around us and you'd like to go out and hear some of the best speakers in the world and investigate some of the most amazing locations on the planet, check out darknessevents.com. darknessevents.com. historicalpodcast.com. And you can join me in a myriad of different locations around the world, from the historic and haunted Palmer House Hotel in Sauk Center, Minnesota, to the Carrington Hotel in Paracon, Australia, coming up on May 23rd and 24th, to Phenomenology in York, Pennsylvania, and more. We've got amazing locations we'll be visiting throughout the year with some of the top paranormal speakers and lecturers, and opportunities to investigate some of the most reportedly haunted and active locations across the planet. Check out darknessevents.com, and you may get a chance to experience the supernatural firsthand. Put yourself into the mix instead of being a passive viewer. Become part of the legend itself. I'm Dave Schrader. I'm the host of Darkness Radio, heard Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight. We explore the strange and unusual, ghosts, UFOs, psychic phenomena, monsters, myths, legends, and more. You can check out my show at darknessradio.com. We have a live stream right there on our website, run through our home station here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, on the Twin Cities News Talk Station, KTLK AM 1130. And what's great is as soon as our show wraps up, we are from 9 to midnight central. You can keep tuned in. The live stream kicks over and picks up George Norrie and Coast to Coast, which will continue your journey into the strange and bizarre. You can also become a Coast Insider and never miss another minute of the best in overnight talk radio by going to coasttocoastam.com, signing up to become an insider. It's only 15 cents a day. It'll get you archives going back 5 years, news, contact with the hosts of this amazing show and some of the best guests in the world in live chat form. You can find all that information and more. And you can follow George Norrie and all of the great projects he's involved in by going to coasttocoastam.com. Check that out. Tonight, we are discussing a skeptic's journey into the CIA's Project Stargate. John Herlosky is our guest for the remainder of the show. We'll open up phone lines in the last hour of the show this evening if you have questions for our guest. When we return, we're going to find out what it's like as a skeptic to actually open yourself to this experience. How hard or how easy is it to connect even when you go into it from a skeptical point of view? We'll find that out from our guest next on Coast to Coast AM. John, talk to me a little bit about the application of remote viewing. What exactly is it used for?
Well, in the past, between the years of 1972 and 1995, of course, it was used during Project Stargate as an intelligence gathering asset. The government says that they no longer use remote viewing. Whether that's true or not, of course, we're not privileged to that. But I do know that a number of the former members of Project Stargate do use remote viewing in under operational conditions. Probably the most best known of those remote viewers is Joe McMonagall, who had the envious distinction of having remote viewer number 001. And Joe currently uses it, remote viewing, to find missing people. And he has been quite successful at it, using just remote viewing. Other than that, I'm not too sure if any of the others are doing operational missions. I know that I have been using it. I work with noted author and former Naval Intelligence Officer, Amy Waters Yarsinsky, and we've been using that, remote viewing, in MIA and POW issues. As a matter of fact, we worked on the Bo Bergdahl case. So there are still applications for remote viewing currently.
When you're collecting the intel, they're not front-loading you. They're not giving you an idea of what exactly it is you're looking for, correct?
For initially, when you initially contact the target, there's no front loading. I should make a caveat of that most of the time. It actually depends upon the mission, but by and large, I would say that yes, there is no front loading on the initial contact with the target. And that way, that gives you solid evidence that your viewer is on the target that you actually want them to be on. It's only after they make contact with the target and you're sure that they are seeing the target that in some cases, not all, but in some cases, a limited amount of front loading might be given in order to focus the viewer's attention on a particular aspect of what he's seeing.
But John, if you don't have any idea of what it is that you're even supposed to be focusing on, how are you reaching out to do that? How are you making that connection?
Exactly.
Because
that
that's what I don't, you know, if somebody came to you.
That was exactly my question when I first heard about all this.
Right, because I would think, okay, they give you a map and they show you this mountain range in Afghanistan and this cave system, and they say, this is what we want you to focus on. We want you to tell us, where in these cave systems can we find Osama bin Laden? Where can we find Saddam Hussein? Where can we find D.B. Cooper, right? They give you these names and ideas. To me, that would seem like, okay, now I have a focal point. It's something that I have a visual reference on. I know what I'm looking at. I know what I'm seeking. Instead, as I understand, they give you an envelope that you don't even open in some cases. And you're just, are you picking up a vibration? Are you picking up a mental intonation of what they're seeking? How do you start? To me, that just seems like it's an impossible feat that they're starting you off blindly without giving you any direction on what you're trying to tap into.
Well, I'll tell you, when I first walked into Dave Morehouse's class and we got our first target, and the only thing I got were two sets of four numbers, and that was it. I was thinking that same question to myself. How am I supposed to get any reasonable information out of two sets of numbers that have no actual real connection to whatever I'm supposed to be looking at? They're encrypted coordinates. They have no relationship to the target. I mean, it just seems so.
And more importantly, no bearing in your mind, right? I mean,
exactly.
These numbers have no point of reference for you to say, okay, I understand what this means at least, so I can, here's a jumping off point.
Mm-hmm. I know, it just seems so crazy. But according to Dave and his book, that's how the remote viewers worked. So I had to take it actually a bit on faith that this technology, this technique would work. But frankly,
well, how does that work for somebody who's a skeptic? How do you go in and go on faith being a skeptic thinking this sounds like a load of crap? How do you wrap your head around that and still open up to have the experience?
Well, I was just fascinated by the thought that the United States government would use something like remote viewing in intelligence gathering. You know, I do admit to enjoying good science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I have read some stories that involve the use of psychic ability, and it's always been very entertaining. Probably the best known of those would be Dune by Frank Herbert, where the Paul Muad'Dib had psychic ability. And I always thought it would be really cool if you had psychic ability. You know, you could spy on your girlfriend, or you could get the lottery numbers or something like that. So I thought to myself, after I had read his book, why not give it a shot? Let's find out if there's anything to this or not. So that's how I got into it.
Was it hard to get past your own mental blocks, kind of thinking this sounded
a
load of malarkey?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, I constantly had to keep from giggling when I was in his first class because I was thinking to myself, well, this sounds like a load of crap. But you know what? I shouldn't have spoken too soon, because after our first target and the lights came on and the other people in the class showed the results that they had, and then Dave put up the feedback as to what their target was, you couldn't deny it. I mean, it was right there in front of you. And, of course, the only person in the class who was not able to see anything was, of course, yours truly.
Okay.
So there I am. Everybody's going up and saying, yeah, I saw this, and I saw that, and I saw this, and I saw that. And I'm slowly sinking farther and farther into my seat, thinking, oh, great, I can't wait till it's my turn, and I get to say, hi, everyone, I didn't see anything. But Dave kind of helped me through that little bump in the journey, so to speak. And on my second try, I was actually able to have a really good session. And that was the thing that turned me around 180 degrees, was the fact that I, with the psychic ability of a sack of hammers, could actually do this. So,
well, how many sessions did you have to work in order for that to open up to you?
Actually, it was the second session. I don't think I would have been able to stick around if I had failed on the second one, because then it would have just reinforced the idea that this is, you know, bull crap. I wanted to give it a solid effort, you know, a truthful effort, and give it my all. And then I could say to myself, well, at least in my case, psychic ability, you know, is just not possible. And, of course, it would color my view about the technology in the future in any case, but at least I gave it 100%.
All right, and I get that, and you're at least remaining open to the possibility of what's going to happen here. When these sessions that you're going in for, how much training goes into it before you get your first target?
Well, when I first went in on the first class with Dave Morehouse, which was held at UCLA in 1999, his lecture series goes on for a number of hours. The technology that he teaches in remote viewing is called CRV, and that stands for, at the time, Coordinate Remote Viewing. The reason being, you get the coordinates, and then you use remote viewing to look at, you know, to view the target. CRV is now generally considered to be controlled remote viewing now. The old term comes from the military. And so a lot of teachers now who teach the technology want to move away from the military application. So they call it controlled remote viewing. But in any case, the lecture series was quite extensive, and it's necessary because the methodology involved here is quite involved. There are actually six different stages to CRV that you have to learn before you can actually really do targets well. So there was a lot of lecture regarding the theory behind remote viewing before you actually do your target.
So you go through all of these, you get your first target, and nothing comes through for you. Other people are hitting, and they're getting things. And how accurate were they? Was it kind of generalization accuracy, or were people hitting it dead on?
There were some that actually drew it almost with photographic ability. I mean, but you have to understand that this was a class of about 20 people, and the results differed among each individual. Some
of
people had, you know, a really good session, really accurate. Others, you know, they had intimations of what the target was. They had aspects of the target. There were some that went off on a little bit of a flight of fancy because their mind was trying to figure out what they were looking at, and they came to the wrong conclusion. But by and large, I would say that the class as a whole, except for yours truly, did really, really well on their first target.
Is that part of the problem, too, when you're doing this, is removing your own psyche, your own id, your own assumptions about what you're experiencing, and just instead of trying to make it fit, just reporting the facts as you're getting them?
Yes, very much so. You, as a matter of fact, have hit it right on the head. being very goal-oriented, being very proactive as a former police officer, you know, you tend to attack the problem. And with remote viewing, what you have to do is you have to let go of all preconceived notion, of prejudice, of ego, of self-doubt, which is another big thing that you have to deal with, and just let it happen. And that was my biggest problem, is being able to just let it happen. It's a much more passive way of dealing with something that I was used to.
We've only got a few minutes left in the segment. Talk to me about that second hit when you went in on the second target. With just a few minutes, what was it like to all of a sudden start to have something occur?
Oh, I didn't believe it at first. I mean, the room that I was in was air-conditioned. It was actually a bit chilly. But when I was in session and I was starting to get impressions, I found myself sweating. I mean, I was hot. And what was happening was I was experiencing an effect called bilocation, where the viewer starts to experience the actual physical manifestations of what's happening at the target. And when it was happening, I opened my eyes to look around the room, and I could feel the air was cool. But I was sweating, and I was hot. And that just, well, that just spun my wheel.
So you were having a tactile experience to a, and I use this term loosely, a hallucinatory moment. You were actually something that you were visualizing and maybe questioning, you were getting a physical response to as though you were there.
Yes. And that, I swear, was just the most amazing thing.
But again, you understand how the mind works and how the brain works. I mean, you've studied psychology and understanding some of this point. So if you're putting yourself in a position and you sense that the place is hot, your body may react that way. I live here in Minnesota. There is some mind over matter that goes on during the winter here. There are days when it's cold out and I'm freezing, and then there's days when I'm not in the mood to be cold, and I can go out in a t-shirt and jeans and motor around in the same temperature it was yesterday. But if my mindset is different, I'm not cold.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
When you have that experience and you're doing this, again, it's differentiating between what is a real experience and a vividly imaginative experience. Does that become part of the pitfalls of this as well? Am I now assuming that because I'm picking up on the fact that I think I'm in the basement of a building next to a furnace, it's going to be hot, and that's what's taking place? Or am I legitimately feeling this heat come off of this furnace?
Well, you have to understand that this was my second time, so I'm still not really thinking that this is going to happen. And as I said, the room was cool, and I was a little chilled. And then as these impressions started to come up, it wasn't just the heat, but I was thirsty suddenly. My mouth was dry, and I could hear yelling and screaming in the distance, you know, lots of noise. So when I open my eyes and I'm looking around, you know, the room is dark because they put the shades down, they turn the lights down low in order to help, you know, get you into that relaxed state. And the room was, you know, I looked around, and because I was out of session at that point, I wasn't hot anymore. You know, the coolness of the room started to come back to me. And I'm thinking, that's weird. And it was dead quiet in the room, except for the sound of people occasionally scratching some words on their paper. And there was no sound coming from the outside, so it wasn't people outside, you know, in the vicinity that I was hearing. It had to have come from the target. So I was just sitting there thinking to myself, this is really strange.
Is remote viewing dangerous? Are there any parts of this that can put the remote viewer in danger physically or mentally? That's part of what we'll cover when we return. Our guest, John Herlowski, our guest for the remainder of the show. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM.